welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. At this momentous time for KPFA and Pacifica, as Uranus, representing nature's evolutionary trickster against all odds, ingenuity, is at 25 plus Aries, which is right where Pacifica's Sun and North Node and Venus were when KPFA was born. Its image is a woman bursting with gifts more than she can hold, and we know that's Pacifica herself. All of us humans are befoibled, but the goddess Pacifica is ingenious, intrepid, and indefatigable, like our guests this hour. So to honor, I'm hosting two of my favorite humans on the planet, agents of sane reverence. In this first half hour, we welcome indefatigable, intrepid agent of dynamic peace, retired Colonel Anne Wright, Code Pink ally, just returned from the International Peace Conference in South Korea, held in the DMZ border city of Cherawan. And we will come right back to that. In our second half, we will be welcoming photographer Chris Jordan, who's just about to release his film on the albatross, Their Beauty and Their Plight, whose life and death by plastic struggles on Midway Island he's been chronicling for years. And this is all part of an unfolding radio series of Let Us Partner with What We Love, Becoming More Like It for Reciprocal Blessing and Protection. So welcome, Anne Wright.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
That's great. So bless your wonderful heart. You're just back, you indefatigable person from South Korea. There's the beautiful picture of you from Code Pink, No War on North Korea. And you are you climbed a nearby hill to look into North Korea. Yeah, and to honor all of the precious life everywhere in North and South. So,
well,
you know, we can...
That's so true. I mean, as we stood up on that hill overlooking the DMZ and seeing North Korea in the background there and thinking about the horrors that have already happened to North Korea and South Korea during the Korean War, and then thinking about should our country attack North Korea and what that would mean and how many people would be killed by that attack. So it was very poignant to be up on top of that hill and to be with a group from the border peace school who climbed the hill every day to meditate up there for peace.
Right, which is exactly where we want to go, the Venusian foreign policy. Oops, strange sounds in the background here. But the Venusian foreign policy is like, again, sane reverence, right? And right, you know, that we would send water and food and warmth and clean energy and ingenious permaculture and fish farming, right?
Indeed, that's what we ought to be doing.
Exactly.
That's what we ought to, instead of the craziness of continual aggressive actions, words, and instead of just dialogue, talking with people, and let's talk this thing out. Instead, the world seems to be on the brink of a possible attack, I think, from the West to North Korea. I don't think North Korea is about to attack anyone, because they certainly know what would happen should they do that. But they've just built up their military forces and their nuclear forces as a protection against regime change, which seems to be the national policy of the United States.
Right. No, it's when the unsupervised, uninitiated Mars boys team, you know, assumes dominance in the cultural lead, they're like, well, as long as North Korea has nuclear arms, we're going to grr. And it's like, yeah, exactly as you said, they saw what happened to Saddam Hussein and, you know, Gaddafi going, you know, it's right. So that's not going to happen. They're not going to give that up, right?
Indeed, they're not. No. And but the way to resolve to the extent that you can. I mean, I don't think the North Koreans will ever trust the United States, as most countries really don't anymore. But to at least come to a place where you can reduce the tensions so that the North Koreans don't feel like the United States is going to attempt a regime change, and actually make some commitments and follow through on them. I mean, from the Clinton administration, where there was a framework of agreement, and yet the Bush administration never followed through on providing the things that were called for in that agreement. And therefore, the North Koreans said, well, if you guys aren't going to follow through, then we'll just continue on our program to develop nuclear weapons, which they have been very successful at.
Yes, all of their resources going into Mars war greediness rather than feeding humans and life and all of that. But by way of kind of circling around, since one of our themes, in a sense, is how do we become more like what we love to partner with it to protect us all, are there things that you love about Korea?
Yes, and in fact, I've been in North Korea, too. Most Americans haven't. Very few of us have. I was in North Korea in 2015 with a group called Women Cross the DMZ, Cross the Demilitarized Zone. 30 women from 15 countries, including two Nobel Peace laureates. We went to North Korea in May and had a two-day peace symposium with 250 women from North Korea, and then a peace walk with 5,000 women in Pyongyang, and then a peace walk with 2,500 women in Kaesong in North Korea, and then went across the DMZ, only the third civilian group allowed to actually cross the DMZ, into South Korea, where then we had a peace conference with South Korean women in the City Hall of Seoul, South Korea, and then a peace march along the DMZ. And a peace march that we had not only in 2015, but also 2016 and then 2017. So I've been in Korea, mostly in the south, but that one trip to the north. And to get to know as best one can in short period of time that, you know, the North Korean people are just like we are. They don't want war. That was the main thing that came out of this the peace conference we had. The North Korean women vividly described what happened during the Korean War from 1950 to 1953, where it was the stated policy of the United States to leave nothing standing in North Korea. And that's what happened. The United States bombed that place until there was just nothing left of it. And that's the memory, the genetic memory, really, of people of North Korea now, that they see what had happened to them, even though that was how many years before, 65 years before. But the memories that are passed down in the families of what had happened then, and then particularly of the last 25 years, the isolation of the international community for the people of North Korea is something that is very vivid for them, of course. And then you look right across the border, right across the DMZ, and you see the country of South Korea, which has been given every opportunity by the international community to have an extraordinary development, industrial development, societal development, which has made South Korea one of the most modern countries in all of the world.
And very big on cosmetics.
And very big on cosmetics, but also very big on all sorts of electronics, all sorts of cars, all sorts. I mean, the industrial might of South Korea is quite remarkable. And when you think that it's the same people that just live, you know, right across the DMZ, that if they had had these opportunities, but there's no need that the country should be in such state. And one could certainly argue, well, they've put themselves a bit in that position by the type of system that they started. But, you know, it has been the international community not really allowing for any sort of major development.
Right. So there's so much we want to unfold. When you went to North Korea in 2015 and on, and you say there are these women's peace marches, so women in North Korea could, without dire consequence, participate with you in peace rallies and marches?
Well, there's no doubt that the government had a hand in selecting the women that we met with. No doubt at all. That doesn't undercut at all their comment that they want peace. And in fact, if you look at the North Korean government, every year they call for an international conference to arrive at a peace treaty. That's been a plea from the North Korean government every single year. because that's what they need in order to, well, maybe feel secure that that the international community, particularly the United States, is not going to overthrow the regime. But they've got nowhere with this plea. And the Western world saying, well, we can't talk to you about a peace treaty until you give up your nuclear weapons. And then now the North Koreans say, are you kidding? Why should we give those things up? Because they're exactly what is keeping you from doing the regime change. So
right.
There's got to be a little bit of a compromise on this thing in order to reduce the tension so that the world will feel a little bit safer that nobody's going to use these things.
Right, but exactly, and again, the Venusian foreign policy somehow smuggling goodness across borders. I guess it falls to the private sector to offer water, food, warmth, clean energy, ingenious permaculture, fish farming. Are there avenues? Well, you know, trickster likes impossible things, but are there avenues whereby private philanthropic ingenious pioneers, you know, Burning Man teams could be welcomed?
Well, indeed, there are such teams already in existence. For example, the American Friends Service Committee, the Quakers, have had an agricultural program in North Korea for the last 35 years.
Uh-huh.
The Mennonites have had an agricultural program in North Korea for 35 years. The Quakers, until about 6 years ago, they were able to bring North Korean agricultural specialists to the United States to show them the things that were being used in the United States to increase agricultural production. However, first with the Obama administration and now on steroids with the Trump administration, the North Koreans are no longer welcome in the U.S., so the Quakers take them to other places in the world to see these things, to help them with agricultural development. Those are two instances of U.S. NGOs that are helping. But when you look at groups from other parts of the world that don't have the same restrictions that the U.S. has on its citizens, you know, right now, under the Trump administration, for the very first time, one is not free to travel to North Korea anytime you want to. Most people never wanted to, so there never was much of a movement of American citizens into North Korea. However, there was the opportunity to go from Beijing to North Korea by getting a visa and then going on what they called the beer tour. Because in little known things about North Korea is that virtually every one of the international hotels has a microbrewery in the basement of it. They brought in Czech and whatever else nationalities that are great beer makers years ago, and they built these microbreweries. So the tourist industry out of China has this three-day trip that you can go up to drink beer in North Korea. Of course, you don't want to pull down any banners or anything like that Warren Buyers kid did that then, you know, got thrown in the clink, and then tragically, whatever happened, that he came out in a coma, which is horrible. But as long as you go by the rules that you don't destroy public property and you act reasonably, don't drink too much beer, you can. Every other country in the world can go into North Korea and do. Now the U.S. has what they call a special validation visa or passport that you have to get in order for an American to legally go into North Korea. So you have to apply to the State Department I would apply under national security issues that I wanted to go talk with groups on issues of peace. But other groups are trying to get humanitarian permission to go in. Other Korean-American groups of Korean-Americans who have family members, families that still live in North Korea who want to see those family members. So now, rather than just being able to apply for a visa from North Korea in Beijing to go in, now you have to get the special validation passport of the United States for North Korea in order to do that.
And we don't know if there's anybody at the State Department answering the phones anymore, right?
Well, from what we've heard, they aren't answering much of them. Apparently, about 100 Korean-American families have applied to be able to go into North Korea to visit their family members, and only one out of 100 have been approved. We do know that the Quakers, the project officer for the Quaker agricultural program, has been able to go in. So she's gotten a special validation visa. But a big test will come when people like myself apply to go in to talk about issues of peace.
Right. And back to beer for a moment. Okay, the microbreweries and the tourist industry. So is North Korea growing its own hops, or is that being imported?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I surely don't. That's when we need to research.
Right. And also, can North Koreans avail themselves of these microbrews? Is there some small sweetness in life?
Well, there is North Korean beer that is not part of the microbrewery industry. The microbreweries that we saw were for those people, the international community that was staying in the international hotels. But we did go to restaurants that had, you know, lots of North Koreans that were eating there, and they were drinking beer too. So I assume there's enough beer to go around. I would hope anyway. And you know, yeah. There are other things that we never realized. I mean, how about apparently a world class ski resort that the South Korean Olympic team has been practicing on for the last week or so? There's a Sea World. I mean, one can say, uh-oh, well, these are only for the elite of North Korea, and that's probably true. But there are these bits and pieces of the country that our media never talks about. They do talk about, you know, the starvation that which has happened in the past. They do talk about the socialist, communist way of running things, except there is now a more of a private market among farmers, where farmers can keep the excess that they grow and sell it on in the private sector. So there are chips in the or chinks in the wall, so to speak, and people who have been in North Korea over the years, year after year after year, say that the changes that they've seen in the last 5 years are quite dramatic, and the types of clothing that people are wearing, the types of shoes they have, the number of cars that are on the streets, that there is a movement in the economic sector which belies the comments that we keep hearing that all of the economy of the country is directed straight into, like, their military and nuclear program. That there is a lot of stuff that's going back into the people.
Right. And then just back skidding back to when you said, and they have a Sea World, I'm like, oh no. In some Gary Larson like cartoon, it's like the orcas are talking and going, and where's your prison? You know, oh, we're going to Orlando, and where's your prison? We're going to Sea World in North Korea. Oh no. What bad luck, Orca. That's poignant. So they have some of the first world colonial horrors of SeaWorld, and we go, all right. But I so appreciate, we all appreciate you weaving again these strands of intimacy. It's like what I've been doing for years with Deborah Felmuth, to weave this intimacy to actual humans in Syria so that we feel that related connection. And you also said the clothing. So clothing, meaning North Koreans have some access to clothing and style. Is that what you're saying? You saw people dressing in, you know, colorful ways, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, it's not like, you know, communist China of the 1960s or the old Russian, you know, the gray garb. I mean, there is smuggling that comes across from China, so they're kind of wearing the same clothes we do, because don't we wear Chinese clothes?
We certainly do, inadvertently, yeah.
Yeah, so it's there is a market that is moving back and forth, even with the, you know, the sanctions, but the sanctions don't really mean much to the people that live right along those border areas. There are television broadcasts that go back and forth. The Chinese You can get special TVs, although the government kind of monitors them, but that they can pick up the Chinese newscasts, which of course would be maligned in the U.S. anyway, but it does give a different view of the world. So, you know, it's not just a monolithic, it's not a monolithic thing. There's some chinks that are going on into what we thought was this great wall of silence coming from North Korea. I mean, I'm kind of interested in the delegation, the North Korean delegation that's going to Seoul. In fact, I think it's today that the sister of Kim Jong-un is actually arriving in Seoul. That is a major statement that they are willing to send her. I mean, I can't imagine what the South Korean security people are going through. Oh, my God, they must be going, oh, my heavens, the potential for something. If anything happens to her while she's in South Korea, it would be a horrific thing.
Right.
So no telling what is going on in the swirl about her, the decision that she would go to South Korea. The first member of the family to go there, I think, since the Korean War.
Wow.
Maybe that's
and
not
so
true. Maybe I think there was Kim Il-sung, I think, did go into South Korea for some talks sometime, but it's been decades since anybody of that rank has been in to South Korea.
So we certainly do, you know, imaginatively, for, you know, what it's worth, if it's not true, let's make it true. We embrace her in a veil of protection and maybe especially protection from any nefarious U.S. forces, right? I mean, because that's the kind of the default, and there's Mike Pence. Oh my goodness! So you didn't quite overlap with him, but there's Mike Pence, and should we just wish him a gag order? Just vines, you know, twining around his mouth. We just don't want him to say anything. No obedient puppet voices. Just what is your best scenario for Mike Pence being there now?
Oh, I think his staying in his hotel room would be the best thing.
or may he be changed by the great genius of Korean fermenting, right? The fermentation, you know. May he be changed by the kimchi. May his his biome be, you know, informed by North and South Korean kimchi. And he goes, I don't know what I've been doing. God, I got to quit as soon as I get back to Washington. Just anything, just the little bacteriological kimchi going. May his digestive system be, you know, changed in whatever. You know, quirky way. But yeah, the Korean delegation, and, you know, I was hearing John Oliver be, you know, charming and grumpy and trivial and profound last night, but he said, I don't hold any hope that, you know, the North Korea, South Korea Olympics, because nothing's ever changed by games. And I go, come on, lad, we work with everything. We don't count on it, but we go, it's a good symbol, right? I mean, it's bypassing the U.S., right?
It certainly is, and it is a great hope when you have young people that are getting involved and are part of some sort of an activity that could result in some major changes in how our societies operate. So I think it's thrilling that these things are happening and under the kind of the auspices of the Olympics, that indeed it is possible that the North and South Koreans will be meeting, apparently, in Seoul on Saturday. The U.S. is not invited, as far as I know, which is probably a very good thing. Let them work it out. I mean, they're the brothers and sisters. It's their Korean family that has been split apart for all of these years, and that could come back together in whatever form that they want. Not what we want, but what they want.
Right, and may it be that in some quirky way, you know, the Trumpelstiltskin Dementors of Doom are helping to unify North and South Korea, because they're like, you know, we're crazy, but we're not that crazy. All right, let's talk over here. That it might be a kind of, you know, bonding, like, you know, two people hugging in a storm, going you know, that there's some incentive and satisfaction, presumably, in bypassing America's current cuckoo regime, right?
Well, I would think so. I think they're all just shaking their heads about what's coming out of Washington and how deeply flawed the U.S. Political system is, and the depth at which the comments of our current president have been hurtful to people around the world. And in the attempts to bring people together trying to resolve serious issues that we have, that could be the fate of the earth could be in jeopardy should the U.S. really stir the pot and I would think initiate a first strike, which would then there would be retaliation on it, and it would just be horrific. So I hope the North and South Koreans on Saturday have great success, that they figure out a way to keep moving forward, to keep the dialogue going, that the United States will butt out of their affairs and let them resolve the issues that are the issues among the Korean family.
Yes, we have a minute or two left in our precious Kahoot. Anne Wright just returned from South Korea, filing scouting reports. But we got to mention our Trumpelstiltskin's desire to have a North Korean like parade in Washington D.C. He wants to be like a little baby dictator. He's kind of. Maybe that'll suck some of the chi out of North Korea's militarism, going, boy, that looks tacky over there. Maybe we'll just calm down over here, since the grown up spot is available now.
Trump is certainly getting tons of pushback on that. I mean, all sorts of people and groups are essentially laughing at him for that type of thing. And I think the military itself, having been in numerous parades. When I was in the military, I mean, those are one of the things that the military hates the most, just having to get out and just, walk down a road in your uniform, and the preparation for all of that, it takes weeks to get those things together, and then the millions of dollars that should be going to other social justice issues and not just having people march down a road with their military weapons.
Yeah, so we do. We want to just suck the chi right out of that thing and exhale it into sanity, going, what would you do with that many millions of dollars, oh, government of D.C. and whatnot? So that's an excellent thing. And is there anything on our way out now also, too? You've guided us in a wonderful way to love, we remember to love fermentation, and we love microbrewing, and we love, the lifting the opaque curtain so that there are actual humans. I should have you back also to give us all a primer on the Korean War, which I think hardly any Americans know what that was, 1950 to 53. It's very dim, like there's hardly any reference to the thing. All right, we've got like 1 minute. We've got 1 minute. Can you remind us what got America into the Korean War of 1950 to 53? What was that?
Well, it is called the Forgotten War, and the war came about really starting back in 1940, 46, when it was the U.S. that arbitrarily drew a line across the Korean Peninsula on the 38th parallel, and the U.S. took control of everything south of it, and the Russians took control of things north of it. And rather than having a unified peninsula, which was what the Koreans were hoping after they had been occupied by the Japanese since the 1918, I believe it was, and had been used and abused by the Japanese, they were ready to get their country back together again. And Kim Il-sung, who was one of the revolutionary leaders who had fought with the Chinese against the Japanese, both in China and then on Korean Peninsula, was set to become the president of all of the Koreas. He was the most famous of all of the freedom fighters, so to speak, against the Japanese. And then the U.S. puppet, Syngman Rhee, was brought in as a counter to the guy who had been in China, kind of like the Ho Chi Minh of Vietnam, Kim Il-sung was of the same right. brand, the revolutionary fighting against the Japanese and the French. And so they split the peninsula to have the U.S. puppet in the South. And that back and forth until 1950, when indeed military actions erupted, and the U.S., as I mentioned before, said, we will flatten all of North Korea. And they did.
You did it, Anne Wright. You gave us a concise history lesson of the Korean War in 1 minute. You are a genius, and I'm going to reluctantly let you go because you have other things. There you are in your perpetual doing good at the University in Hawaii and off to do other wonderful things. But it's a delight to cahoot with you. Thank you so much for you and your work, and I hope to cahoot further soon.
Well, thank you for cahooting. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
It's absolutely a pleasure. Thank you so much, Anne Wright. And also, we were about to take our very short break, just 1 minute after the midpoint. But we are at the midpoint of our show, and we're going to introduce our ally after the break, who is our ambassador, really, from Midway Island at the midpoint. We'll be welcoming Chris Jordan, who's just about to release his film on the albatross, their beauty and their plight. And we'll be right back after this very short break. Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and we don't know what happened to our Taj Mahal break music, but that was enough jazz to disrupt our normal thought patterns in a good way. Welcome back to part two of the Visionary Activist Show. We just said goodbye to our wonderful ally, Anne Wright, weaving intimacy, you know, between us and North and South Korea. There we go. And for our second half, it's perfect, and we can segue this. We welcome longtime ally Chris Jordan, who is just about to release his film on the albatross, their beauty and their plight, whose life and death by plastic struggles on Midway Island he's been chronicling for years. And this is all part of our unfolding radio series of Let's Partner with What We Love, Becoming More Like It for Reciprocal Blessing and Protection. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you, Caroline.
Ah, splendid. So there's many places we want to go, but first, you know, you've been working on this film, albatrossthefilm.com, for a long time, and you're just getting ready to release it as a gift to the world, right?
Yes. The film is finished after 8 years of work, and the only thing we have left to do is to create a streaming platform and a website and kind of do the technical stuff in the background before we let Albatross fly out into the world.
Right. So I certainly, we met many years ago, in British Columbia, seeing your incredible slideshow about Midway Island and the albatross and their beauty and the horrific beauty that you documented of so many of them dying by inhaling, eating plastic from top to bottom, filled with our detritus, our plastic lighters, our bottle caps, and so on. And so you've been going there for how many years? Remind us.
Well, I made a total of 8 trips there over, I think it was 5 years, between 2009 and 2013. And then since then, I've been working with my footage and putting the film together.
Right. And I remember the early parts of it, but I'm delighted. And it was a wonderful connection because I was, asking great allies, going, all right, if we want to become like what we love in order to form an alliance, you know, to protect it, you know, and I want to be scheduling many, many beautiful people, you know, who, and they were like, Chris Jordan. I go, I know him, of course, that's right, here we are. So how do we become like what we love to form an alliance with it in so many ways? And so the albatross, you know, when many of us first saw your slides show, it did bring people, certainly including myself, to their knees in grief, appropriate grief, going, we've got to change this way. And as we know, you know, by 2050, scientists report, if we don't change our rogue species behavior, there will be more plastic in the ocean than fish. And I want to toss it to you, because you can give us Anne Wright did the history of the Korean War in a minute. That was pretty good. But it's also now, you know, you're finding some ingenious response from the albatross now, right?
Well, this is a really fascinating piece of the story that's happening on this remote island. Is the albatrosses are not going extinct out there. And if they were, then the whole conversation would have to be about saving the birds. But the birds are actually doing okay. Midway is a marine national monument and a national wildlife refuge. And so they are protected there. And the Fish and Wildlife Service makes it very difficult for people to go there, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that tens of thousands of the birds are dying by ingesting plastic, they seem to be reproducing faster than the plastic is killing them. And so the population of birds is actually increasing for the time being.
But the population's increasing, but maybe their longevity is shortening.
Yeah, it could be. The thing that the scientists say who are studying them, despite being really scientifically annoying, it's the most accurate thing that can be said about the plastic, and that is that it is increasing their mortality by an unknown factor. And so in that way, it's a little bit like cancer in humans. You know, cancer is on the rise, and many people die from it, and our population is increasing. And so since I went to the island the first time, when I first went there, the population of albatrosses was about 1 million. And in only 8 years, their population has gone up to 1.5 million.
Right. Right. And you, when we were speaking backstage, you said, you know, the carrying capacity of the island, you know, for mammals would be whatever, but the food supply is vast in the ocean, not just plastic, but...
Yeah, when you talk about the carrying capacity of an ecosystem, if you were to imagine, you know, this tiny little island that's barely larger than a college campus, imagine on that island putting 1 million deer. You know, they would all starve to death in no time flat, because in most cases, the carrying capacity of an ecosystem is determined by the food supply. And for albatrosses on Midway, their food supply is the entire Pacific Ocean. And so the only thing they need on the land, the only reason they come to land is just to be able to hatch their babies on firm ground. And so literally the only thing they need on the land is the land itself, is like the elbow room. And so nobody knows how many Laysan albatrosses could inhabit Midway if they wanted to, but it could be a number much, much bigger than 1.5 million. But there's
right.
another thing going on there that going to eventually threaten them, and that is sea level rise is going to wipe out all of the atolls in the Pacific Ocean, because those atolls, they're only, you know, 4 feet above sea level at their highest point. And Midway is only a little bit higher than that in some places, just because little piles of sand were bulldozed back when it was a base. But, you know, it only takes one extreme hurricane event and a little bit of additional sea level rise to completely take out one of those atolls. And so the albatross, nobody knows how it is or why it is, but the albatrosses on Midway, for some reason, have begun leaving the safety of their island and populating some of the islands in the Hawaiian chain that are... they're populating cliffs that are like 400 feet above sea level now. So there's some interesting intelligence going on in the background that's quite mysterious.
Right, because what you'd also said, you know, backstage is, you know, on Midway Island there are no predators. You know, it's really their scene, aside from the plastic poison of what they fly hundreds of miles to bring back to their babies and feed them the plastic, which we want to keep circling back to in a sense. But you'd also said, you know, so they're leaving Midway where there's no predators, and they're going to Hawaii where there are many predators. But you said they're roosting 400 feet above. Which is a big evolutionary change, right, for the babies being born, from being born on a little flat place where you can learn to fly to 400 feet above, where your first flight is a more daunting affair, right?
Yeah, it's so interesting to think of how those babies are going to survive. Because on Midway, the kind of the way the process goes of the young birds learning to fly is the beaches slope very gently down into the sea. Right. So when the fledglings make their first attempt, they might just stand on the beach and flap their wings for a while in the wind, and then they might fly 50 feet out and land in the water and then swim back. And then the next time they fly out 1,000 feet or whatever. And in the case of birds, some of the ones on the bluffs that we saw on the island of Kauai, the very first time the bird ever flies, it's sort of do or die.
Right, that's it. Right, which we know from, you know, Winged Migration, you know, a beautiful documentary, and going, oh, nature is tough by itself without humans messing with it and making it harder, you know. And I forgot which kind of bird, but it was that those were the birds on the cliff, and their first little thing was, that's it, you know. And you see the little goslingish bird, you know, going and then tumbling. You go, oh my god, and then it lands after all this, and then it's like, oh, that was intense, and it gets up, and the parents hover around it, and we go, that's really a rough thing, you know, boy, you know, American teenagers don't know anything about that. I'm going, whoa. So we do wonder, but again, all that you're narrating, it reminds us of, you know, yay life. I like, you know, remembering Terence McKenna saying, you know, when life emerged from the ocean and felt the pull of gravity, you know, and first thought, you know, can we do this, emerge from the ocean into the land with the gravity? And he said, life always responds with, you betcha. So, you know, as many impediments as we humans are, there's this admirable ingenuity of experimental response on the part of life, which carries a lot of risk. And we do want to, you know, there's the larger species of albatross. We were talking about the intelligence of things, that anything that has a name has a god or a presiding intelligence or a deity. There's large species realms, and then there's, you know, individuals that we connect with by that gaze, you know, the gaze of, like, the albatross. Well, because you have a lot of photographs of eyes, right?
And this is one of the characteristics of albatrosses that really astonished me, that I always, for some reason, had the idea that creatures with much smaller brains than we have wouldn't have the same level of curiosity and affection and tenderness between each other. But the more time I got to spend with the albatrosses, the more I saw that not only are they incredibly curious, like, you can see a bird, if you walk out into the field and sit down with a camera, you can see the ones that are curious from 100 feet away, just looking like, what is that thing over there? And instead of responding in fear and running away or flying away at this unknown entity that they're perceiving, you see them looking, and then they slowly start walking toward us. And they come closer and closer and closer and closer until literally their beak is right next to our face, and they might nibble on our earlobe a little bit. And just in the absence of having had predators,
right,
for millions of years, there's this sense of openness that is instructive on a spiritual level.
Well, curiosity is a top part of, you know, collective intelligence. We really like that, and I do always remember, you know, polar bear grieving polar bear expert going, by saying, you know, it's one of the top intelligences of curiosity on this planet because there's no top predator, you know, and the famous photo of the Russian submarine surfacing right next to a polar bear and the polar bear striding over to going, yeah, who the hell are you? And to lose that, you know, and what you're saying is, you know, curiosity, you know, comes from a non-predator, you know, not having a predator realm of security going, because curiosity is intrinsic to us. And just as a wild sidebar, but it's kind of connected to our Kahoot, I loved listening to this woman who had been giving a talk on why we laugh at TED and was being interviewed afterwards. And the interviewer said, well, why when people smoke marijuana do they sometimes giggle and laugh and in a way that other people go, rah, rah, silly, rah, rah, whatever. And the woman said, it's not that marijuana makes people laugh. It's that we are intrinsically a laughing, giggling species. And it just takes away the constraint. And we have a kind of backload of suppressed laughter that then can emerge. And I love that. We're meant to be a curious, laughing, giggling species. It's intrinsic to our nature. So lighten up, everybody. And then back to the curiosity, like, hello, what's up? What's up? And that's where we were talking about, you know, there's species and then there's individuals, you know, within it. And, you know, and that's where the gaze comes in, the particular gaze of the hyena, the coyote, the deer, that's really intimate, right? That gaze.
Yeah, and you know, this was something, a part of being with these birds that was really challenging for me, was that the looking into the eyes of an albatross, in one way you can see their curiosity when they approach us, but approaching them, like seeing a pair of albatrosses, a couple snuggling in their nest, and approaching them and looking into their eye, I could never make the kind of connection that I wanted to make, like the way we make with a mammal. Like when we look into the eyes of our pet dog, there's just so clearly like this very mammalian recognition of the love between us. And with albatrosses, it was more like looking into the eyes of a lizard. Like, I just couldn't connect with them.
And even without your camera, because the camera's a little trippy.
Yeah. But you can see how connected they are with each other. And there's a tremendous amount of affection. And just an obvious mutual adoration that they have for each other, snuggling in their nests, sitting in a position where their cheeks are touching each other for hours at a time. And yet, it was impossible to kind of jump that gap and to create a relationship with them. And it was something that I just had to accept, that I can't relate to them. And I can't ever really connect with them. And finally, I realize that's okay. I can respect them as an other and still love them just as much and want to protect them and make sure that their environment is protected at the same time as realizing we're never really going to be able to connect with them and understand them.
I wonder, you know, without presumption or default human hubris, you know, and we were speaking backstage about the role of plant entheogens, and I would often say that when I would come back on a journeying kind of way and be greeted by Stella Coyote, the half-coyote companion of my life, she would go, "Ooh, you're in my world now." And I wonder if the rise of plant entheogens, what they are, what they represent as intrinsic capacity, whether one imbibes or not, is a capacity to cross borders imaginatively, without presumption, without whatever. But it is why reptile beings, you know, we do stare at a snake, and part of why it's so spooky is that it doesn't really look like there's a lot of negotiation possibility, you know, with the eye gaze to the snake and the whatever. It's more, can't be charmed. I don't think snakes can be charmed. there are snake charmers. But anyway, but these are all worthy for infinite rumination. But crows, very engaging, like, caw, caw, how are you? How are you? What's that? What are you? You know, and that's also, you know, I think, you know, to cross, experimentally be willing to cross borders, and maybe the, you know, like training wheels, the entheogenic plants are little assists in being able to imaginably cross species borders. But it's a good, it's a worthy point that you bring up. I mean, they are alien beings. But I do love the quote that one of my favorite Lauren Isley quotes: "We are rag dolls made out of many ages and skins, changelings who have slept in wood nests or hissed in the uncouth guise of waddling amphibians. We have played such roles for infinitely longer than we have been men. Our identity is a dream. We are process, not reality, for reality is an illusion of the daylight, the light of our particular day." So we've been those beings, you know, is really, you know, in our quirky journey, but that's it's a useful point to put on our deliberative altar of like, right. And then, you know, for you, let's see, in our wonderful time left, we want to go beauty is stronger than dominance, but also, you know, the film that we mentioned at the top of our cahooting here is how can people find out about that, because you are giving it as a gift to the world for streaming, right?
Yes, I've decided to completely bypass the whole paradigm of the economy, of the money economy and the commercial film economy, and just offer the story of Albatross in the same spirit that it came to me, just as a gift. And so what we're doing is setting up a streaming platform that will just be through our website, which is albatrossthefilm.com. And people can go there now. If you go to albatrossthefilm.com, you can sign up your email, and then when we have everything set to go, you will receive an email that will be the film. And then what we're inviting is for people to share it together as a way of kind of creating community. And as you see when you watch it, it's a little different than other documentary films. It's kind of not so much of an informational download as it is more like a meditation, or even you might even call it a grief ritual. And that's something that's better experienced in community with others. And so we're offering people to host a screening of any size, whether it's just in their living room with a couple of friends, or at their school, or anywhere.
Right, and our ally, friend of show, Terry Tempest Williams, who had said, try Chris Jordan. I go, I love Chris Jordan. But she said it was screened at Harvard just now, right?
Yeah, I just got back. It was screened there 2 days ago, I have to say it was an astonishing experience. It was kind of transcendent, because Harvard is showing some interest in bringing the notion of spirituality and feeling, you know, kind of recognizing across disciplines our love for the world, and bringing a sense of reverence and wonderment back into the fields like science. And so there was a whole group of, there were some scientists, some people from art departments, and then also from the Divinity School, who all came, and we watched Albatross together and then had a panel discussion. And I haven't felt so hopeful in a long time after being with those people.
Well, hopeful in the sense of the response, and also the dissolving of false boundaries between art and science?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And the just kind of reawakening of what I believe is of all of our fundamental state of being, you know, whoever we are and whatever role we play in the world, I believe what we're fundamentally made of is love. And if we could just remember that together, can you imagine what would be on the other side of that doorway?
Well, that's also a great discipline you've been navigating, you know, through our alliance through the years too, because, you know, you said you didn't want to be involved in too much disaster or grief pornography, where it was like, oh, it's so horrible, oh my God, it's so horrible, it's so sad, and it's all those things. And, you know, where what we were speaking about, you know, beauty is stronger than dominance, may it be so, and kinship stronger than war, rising up, rah, 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 rah. You know, and you said the ego can persist easily in horror, but you said walking under stars, you know, we dissolve our sense of separateness, and we go, right, so it's an intriguing dynamic, right, of directing at what we must know, you know, the effect of our species' actions on the rest of our kin. We must know that without, you know, so I know we're born the same day, October 14th. You know, it's a balancing act too about, okay, how are you thinking, feeling, navigating that now?
Well, you know, for the longest time, before the Midway Project, as an environmental activist, I was in a kind of paradigm that I didn't even realize I was in, which is thinking and focusing only about the bad news. And it was just a sort of kind of energy of, everything is really bad and it's getting worse all the time and we aren't doing enough. And being immersed in the transcendent beauty of this island and seeing these incredible beings who, what they do most of the time is sing and dance all day long, all night long. You have to wear earplugs to sleep at night because a million albatrosses are literally singing and dancing all night long. And with the Milky Way overhead at night so brightly that you can walk around just by the light of the stars, it's an experience of beauty that just can't help remind one that all of the horror that we humans could ever dream up is always held in an envelope of magnificence and majesty and the miracle that we're all a part of. And so I feel like I'm maybe have been stepping into my role as a Libra lately, holding those two things in balance. And that doesn't mean we can turn away from the darkness. We have to, as Terry Tempest Williams so wisely says, we cannot avert our gaze. We have to keep looking. And at the same time, we can also keep looking into the beauty of our world and let that be the fuel that reminds us of what we love and gives us our greatest power to act.
That's great. It's again, wonderful South African ally Krena Alcock says, love is worth nothing until it has been tested by its own betrayal. Right, so it is that dynamic, beauty stronger than dominance, beauty stronger, you know, and the ego persists in horror. So to be fully informed, compassion with sizzle, you know, as Wendell Berry encourages, I'm going to get his quote wrong slightly again too, but it's like, know all the facts and be jaunty anyway, right? So it's like we gotta know and choose beauty and life, but it only has power if we know how terrible and horrible it is. Otherwise, it's like, oh, it's all very good. You know, there's no power to that thing. Thank you, great ally. We're on our way out, but we are dedicated to cahooting in perpetuity. Thank you for your beautiful work. May people go to chrisjordan.com and or albatrossthefilm.com to avail themselves of your great balancing act between grief and redemptive beauty, because you're such a great scouting reporter in that realm. Thank you.
Thank you, Caroline. Love you, darling. Talk to you
soon. All right. We're over and out. Thanks so much to Antonio Ortiz, who is a great ally board op at KPFA. Thank you very much. And always to our guests. And we will reconvene next week, coyotenetworknews.com, for many ways to play. Thank you, team. Oh, yeah,
As U.S. capitalism declines, basic change is needed. So listen up. That's the commanding title of a new talk to be given by who else? Richard Wolff. The superbly sardonic Marxist economist will speak in Berkeley Wednesday evening, February 21st, 7:30, at First Congregational Church, 2345 Channing Way. Wheelchair accessible, hosted by Sabrina Jacobs. Wolf's talk is a benefit for KPFA Radio and for Democracy at Work. Tickets at fine independent bookstores that support KPFA, as well as online at brownpapertickets.com. That's February 21. Be at Berkeley's First Congregational Church to hear The Wolff.